Those Chronicles Stories of the Supernatural. And today I'm at a super special, unusual place. This is in Knoxville, Tennessee. And where I'm at right now, you know, and you'll see from the video I'm going to take that it's a beautiful park. But originally, this was known as the East Tennessee Insane Asylum. And it was opened in 1886. And then in 1927, it became the Eastern State Psychiatric Hospital. And then in the 1960s, like a lot of the stories you hear about these psychiatric hospitals, that the state would send people that, you know, were institutionalized for whatever reason, they reached a capacity of about 2,800 patients. And then in about 1977, the name was changed to Lakeshore Mental Health Institute. Okay, a little bit more politically correct. And believe it or not, it closed in 2012 after 126 years of bringing in basically people with different types of mental illnesses, whether they were here temporarily or whatever the case might be. This is where they would be brought to. And I know a lot of you have heard stories from different psychiatric hospitals in different states, especially in the earlier years, where people were placed here, people that needed to be placed here, but there was also people that ended up here for things that really, in other words, they just put everybody in here. And when it's a state-run institution, your indigents, your undesirables, they end up here too. And of course, like any of these locations that has too many patients, not enough facilities, not enough staff, you do have reports of abuse and what also comes with it, which is stories of hauntings, which is not surprising because a lot of the people that lived and ultimately died here were very confused because maybe they had a disease of the brain, had psychological problems. Many times their lives were tragic and they died under tragic circumstances. So it's inevitable, like in a lot of these sanitariums across the United States, that you have residual hauntings. Because of course, there were 126 years, there were certain things that were done year after year, like certain noises or even smells, and then you have the intelligent hauntings. These are the entities that that there is some type of intelligence behind them. They're trapped souls, whether they're aware that they're dead or they're not. The reports are here that in what's called Lakeshore now, there have been sightings. After 2012, when it was closed, they have demolished a lot of the buildings, but there's still some that are left. And like I said, when you roll in here, it's a beautiful, beautiful park. It's got about 100 acres on it. It's really large. It's a beautiful park here in Knoxville, Tennessee, but there's still some buildings left, and that's what we're going to take a look at. And let's see if we can even locate where they buried these patients at. Because truth be told, if you look in the internet, there's not much information on it, of course, but I'm sure that after 126 years serving at a hospital, they had to bury some of these people somewhere. Not everybody picked up the family members' bodies or the remains and buried them in a different cemetery. So let's see what we can find. Again, like a lot of these locations, unfortunately, I can't get here after dark, when it would be great to do an investigation or to get some EVPs or any type of evidence. So I'm gonna get what I can get, which is daytime hours. Let's see what happens. It's Marlene again, and here I am at the Tennessee Insane Asylum, or at least that's what it was once. These are the grounds, like I'd explained earlier. A lot of the buildings that were part of the grounds that housed the people that had mental problems, they've already been destroyed. Not all of them, but this is, and as you can tell, they're building new things. They're making parks, but it's a beautiful, beautiful view from here. And over here, let's see what we've got. I think this is one of the few buildings that's still standing. I don't know if it's the administration building
or what it might be, but let's see. Let's see what this is. Okay. All right, yeah, these are memorials, I think, for different buildings, because at one point in the 1920s, I believe it was 1927, it became known as Eastern State Hospital. This was the Eastern State Hospital Nurses Home, erected 1942 under the direction of the Charitable and Penal Institutions Commission. Blah, 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 blah. And then it's just naming the architects and the contractors. Okay, then I guess 6 years later, they put this, which was the women's dormitory building, erected 1948. Same thing, under the direction of the Charitable and Penal Institutions Commission. Okay, and this was the earliest one, 1941. Eastern State Hospital Treatment Building, erected 1941. The Charitable and Penal Institutions Commission, which leads me to believe that that of course they were housing. Penal means a prison. So, okay, this one was here, was torn out. Here's another one. Jane Keller Building. Okay, dedicated May 26, 1967, first director of nursing service. This one was erected by the state of Tennessee, Prentice Cooper, the governor. And then in 1952, Eastern State Hospital Men's Dormitory, erected 1952 under the direction of the Charitable and Penal Commissions. So as you could tell, throughout the years, they kept adding buildings. And unfortunately, from what I understand, a lot of them have been demolished. And up here you can see the flags at half staff. Unfortunately, today there was a massacre of many human beings in Las Vegas by a crazy man. And so I'm traveling around, I'm listening to the news, it's very heartbreaking. And it's almost like I'm here at a place that used to house people that had psychological problems and diseases of the brain, and it makes me want to think, without knowing the details or the specifics of why this man did this, that he had to have been suffering from something in his head, that he was pure evil. But yes, that's why the flags that flying at half staff today. Oh, let's see. Okay, this is the administration, erected 1884. Okay, so I think this was the original building. Let's see. By the way, I take it back. This park is not 100 acres. It's twice as much. It's 195. But not surprisingly, I just went into the administrative building, which has right now been turned into the equivalent of a park's headquarter. And I guess that's why the left is standing. Even though this was the original 1884 building where I guess they manage the state hospital from. They have a bunch of very loose information about Knoxville Parks. Little or nothing. When I say little or nothing, I mean little or nothing about the background of this park, except to say that it's being converted from what used to be the hospital grounds to a park. but they have no historical information. And you know what? I can't understand why the hurry to totally demolish all these buildings, because I'm sure that with 195 acres, there's plenty of space to spare, where they could have left some of the buildings still standing for historical purposes and maybe demolish some that were beyond, you know, being rebuilt. And but yeah, I think they want to erase the fact that this place used to be a place where people with mental illnesses were kept.
Yeah, guys, here I am in that ex-mental asylum in Knoxville, Tennessee, that nobody, that they're trying to like make magically believe it never existed inside of a park. And here I am trying to find out, where did they bury these people? There's nowhere. There's a cemetery for any of the patients that were, had to have died here during 126. So I came out here to what looks to have been maybe the old church, and they renovated it and they hollowed it out. And guess what I found? Because I was thinking, okay, usually burial grounds are usually very close to or adjacent to the churchyard. And guess what I found out here? There's no markers, but there's a company out here called Underground Detective. Which leads me to believe that underground detectives are usually used to find where there's burial sites. Okay. Yeah, utility locations, pipe inspections, vacuum excavation, ground penetrating radar. That's a nice way of saying, yes, we need to find out very discreetly where the bodies are buried. So, this is really unusual, and they could say it's for pipes, but I'll tell you this much, what he's looking at is a totally open field. Open field. But he's out there trying to locate pipes. See what I mean? There you go. So I'm telling you, they really want to keep it on the down low what happened or what went on over here at this hospital. Don't get me wrong, I can understand repurposing a piece of land for a park, but they totally want to obliterate. By the way, that administration building, the facade is old looking, but inside you can tell it's been totally renovated. And considering that they had patients here as recently as 2012, which is 5 years ago, I am surprised that there is little or no, when I say no evidence here, that these grounds once belonged, had mental hospital, and from what I've seen, they probably even had housing for some of the nurses at some point. Incredible. I can't find anything. I've been traveling round and round. I can't find anything. Let's see if I get lucky. I come across anything.
Hi, everybody. This is Marlene again. And you saw me when I was out there at what is left of the East Tennessee Insane Asylum. I mean, it's gone through different names, and I'm just using one of the original ones. And I did find out afterwards that supposedly they did have a separate burial site for about 4,000 of the patients that were there throughout the years, the ones that, for example, that the families never reclaimed their bodies. I still thought it was kind of unusual, though, to have one of these companies that did ground penetrating work out in an open field where nothing was there. From what I've looked at, a lot of, as a matter of fact, I think all the buildings, with the exception of the administration building, had been demolished because people that have gone there between 2012 to now had documented where there were other buildings that were still there. But by now, the only thing they have is the administration building, which they renovated, And as you could see when I went in there, it's beautiful, it's sleek. And you're going to, one of the things I commented is the grounds are beautiful. And I can understand where they would want to repurpose this beautiful area for a park for everybody to enjoy. But at the same time, I kind of felt disappointed that they had gone ahead and tried to totally erase any type of history from what was there or the people that lived there for so many years. Because this is the thing, and you saw from those memorials, it wasn't only patients that lived there. Throughout the years, especially in the earlier years, the nurses and the people that worked there, the matrons, they used to live on this, you know, on this land. You know, they had their the different building, obviously, where people could, you know, would you basically work there all the time. You lived there. And I thought, you know, I without knowing the exact conditions of some of these buildings, I still feel like they want to totally erase what was there. Almost acting shamefully about it. At least that's the way I feel. So, but anyway, I thought, you know what? Let me go and look up some history about this place, because it's obvious that by visiting there, when I walked into the lobby, I was hoping that they were going to have either pictures or some type of literature on the history of what was used to be there before. Nothing. Everything was very general, like county park information, and that was it. And it's I just don't agree with that. I really don't agree with that. But let me go ahead, and I wanted to give you guys some information about the history and of some information that I was able to pick up about some of the people that were actually committed there and others that worked there, which sometimes. And the reason why I do this, not only besides that the history is interesting, a lot of times you get a good idea of who is contributing to the hauntings that supposedly are even going on now, even though the buildings have been demolished. And you do hear that a lot, where hauntings and things are experienced by people, even though a house or structure has been demolished, even in open fields, or where they put something else and then people start experiencing things and they can't account for it, even though they considered that they're in a brand new house and or a brand new building. And then guess what? Surprise! Okay, so let me go ahead and I'm going to show you some interesting slides about this place, and then we'll go into the hauntings. But if anything, they deserve to have their history told. Okay, so you're going to see from the different slides. Before I even get into that, I'm going to talk about what they called poor houses. And this, I'm sure maybe you've heard about them in some of the TV shows that they have about that, where paranormal teams go into investigate asylums, where a lot of these locations, before they use the term asylum, that's what's called poor houses. All right, now in very early Tennessee, which is where this asylum is located, the care for the elderly, the poor, the infirm, if there was any type of mental illness, was the responsibility of the family. However, if that person didn't have a family that were either there or able and willing to assume their care, okay, in other words, there was no home to have them live out, some of the counties would use jails to house the mentally ill. And that was very unfortunately, because basically you were taking a person that was just ill and placing them among criminals. So they also had what was called almhouses. And the poor houses, and again, these were all county-owned poor farms, and mostly they were developed by the local communities, and almost every county had some version of a poor farm, what they called a poor house or a poor farm. And the reason why sometimes even called poor farm is that these locations sometimes would even farmed the land. In other words, they were self-sustaining. And sometimes what they said is that it may have been as simple as the county contracting with a farmer just to take in a pauper for a monthly stipend. And that the county would say, you know, we're going to go ahead and we'll pick up the bill on this. Now, notice, we're here, we're not talking where they were discerning between somebody that was mentally ill. It could have been if you were mentally ill, if you were disabled, if you were a woman and you had become a widow and you had children and you couldn't support yourself. Everybody was thrown under the same. That's how they tried to resolve that problem. Basically, what the county was doing is that they were farming out the care of these destitute to private citizens, and then eventually over the years, these poor houses would change location. So you would have a succession of different what served as poor houses, like within the county. Mostly, they did this also because of insufficient revenue. In other words, they didn't have the money to actually do what they eventually did, which was buy land and build a structure. All right. Which is what I told you, they, these county owned poor farms could produce saleable crops in order to offset the costs. Now, back in 1826, the Tennessee General Assembly, they granted what was Anderson County permission to build what they call an almshouse. And then in 1927, it went off to all the other counties. Okay. And I guess they realized that by just giving people over to private citizens to be taken care of, that wasn't going to work long term, especially as populations start to grow. Now, that area where the hospital or the facilities was located was known as Lyon's View. And it was a name taken from William Lyon, Captain William Lyon, who made his home on the grounds before they developed the hospital. And then in 1874, his daughters, they conveyed about 300 acres of the Lyon property over to the state of Tennessee, which established what they call the Hospital for the Insane. And what happened was, like in 1873, 1874 was when they made the decision. They had a lot of infighting, believe it or not. And the thing was that there was another hospital near Knoxville, which was already overcrowded. It was an insane asylum near Nashville, and it was already overcrowded. So they were hoping to be able to transfer people over to this new one. Finally, by 1886, in other words, they purchased this land in 1873, 1874, and it takes them till 1886 before they finally were able to open the doors again because of infighting, lack of money. And originally it had a capacity for about 250 patients, and at that time they did give it a lot of the modern facilities because it was heated by steam and it was lit by coal oil lamps. And at that time, like I said, the families of the superintendent, the physician, the steward, and the matrons lived on the top two floors, probably of that administration building or of the original ones. Then in 1896, they built what they called the Underhill Building. Okay, and this was for black patients, and it was not integrated until the 1960s, okay? Because again, this was around the time that segregation was abolished, and so for all those years, for about 60 something years, they had segregated care for people that were taken there. They were in a different building. Now, back in the early 1900s, okay, there was actual physicians that were basically being licensed towards treating mental illness. Okay, in other words, they realized that they needed to have a separate field to treat people that had mental illnesses. And this is when they were looking at people that were affected by syphilis, because syphilis can affect your brain. Also the effects of malaria, all these things that eventually could, if you don't have a psychological problem, can, you know, your brain could be hurt. And also this was around the time that they were looking at how they were treating people that were coming in for any type of mental illness, or brain disease. And at that time, believe it or not, and you have to understand, there was really no great optimism that people were going to recover. Back then, if you ever got pegged as being insane or mental disorder or what they call feeble-minded, there was no prognosis like, oh, well, this person will get therapy like we have now, and they'll get better. That was it. Now, and that was another thing, you know, there was a lot of stigma also attached to this. Now, just to give you an idea, like back in 1900, okay, there was a murder. Back then, they would call it Lion's View. This hospital was, even though it was East Tennessee Insane Asylum, they would also call it Lion's View. There was a murder back in April of 1900 where a Miss Mary Carter got killed by another patient getting a slat from a bed and hitting her over the head. Another lady by the name of Martha A.G., an insane woman. They were both in the same room. They had an argument, and one hit the other one with a part of a bed and killed her. They were not known to be dangerous. And of course, because I was reading all the information on it, you know, the hospital superintendent, like, no, we would never have housed them there if there was any thought or belief that they were dangerous. But what are you going to say after one woman kills another? All right, now let's fast forward. It's 1915, and there was a Dr. Michael Campbell. He was the first and longest serving superintendent, and he had resigned. And he had tried really hard to, like, update it. In other words, he was always trying to update it, but he kept getting basically... he couldn't go forward with, like, progressive methods because, like, the government was penny-pinching. So he really had a hard time trying to keep it up to date. All right. And he resigned. This was in 1915. And as a matter of fact, they did, back in that time, they did like a comparison, and they said that the state spent about 37.5 cents a day on each patient, less than it did on prisoners. And I guess I bring that up, so if you ever want to get an idea, you know, what kind of conditions, you know, maybe things were within those walls, they were spending less money on these patients than they were on people that were prisoners. And believe me, back around this time, prisoners were not treated well. If you were in jail or in prison, it's not like it is now. All right. And this is also when they start talking about that it became what they call a custodial institution. In other words, it was overcrowded with patients of all types. Everybody housed together, and also that they started to use, you know, restraints and things of this nature. And unfortunately, that happens because they were basically sending everybody there. As you could see when I was looking at at some of the memorial plaques that they had on there, that penal word, that means that they were sending their people that maybe might have been considered criminally insane and weren't sent to jail, but would be sent here as well. All right. Now, there's another one. There was another interesting article dated 1923. Okay. And the reason why I brought this up, because it gives you an idea of what people would do to, you know, you always hear these stories about people being committed against their will into an asylum. And this is kind of what this doctor tried to do in 1923. Okay, there's a doctor whose name is Dr. Reed Russell Crabtree. Dr. Reed Russell, and he's from Crab Orchard, Tennessee. Okay, so he gets a hold of the people at this hospital, and he's telling them, I'm going to be coming in on a train with a patient, and please meet me there. With a woman patient, please meet me there. So I'm going to turn her over to you guys because she's insane. All right. So a policewoman, okay, shows up with like two women from the hospital thinking, okay, here's this doctor coming to commit a patient, a woman patient that needs to be hospitalized. Guess what? It turns out that, I was also impressed. This was 1915. This was 1923. And they had a lady policewoman. They had a policewoman. Okay. And she starts getting suspicious because he's got her tied down, in one of the train sections. And when they, come to, escort her out, she starts telling that they find her lying on a cot. And they start getting suspicious when her name and his name are the same. I guess their surnames are the same. Basically, she tells these ladies, you know what? That man wants to leave me here, and don't let him get away. He's going to Florida, and he has dope, I'm quoting this from the newspaper, in his possession. Hold him and search him carefully. Guess what? He was right. This guy was a drug fiend, okay? And he was going to dump his wife in a hospital and take off to Florida. He got arrested, of course. But the reason why you can laugh now. Thank God these two women, or all the women involved there, that, you know, the police lady and the two women from the hospital, kind of like, but this guy, you could probably, under the influence of drugs, thought that he was going to be able to pull this off. Here he was. He was ready to commit his wife to an insane asylum and take off to another state. Okay. Here's another one. 1924. Okay. There was a guy by the name of D.R. Barrett, okay? He had been an attendant at the Eastern State Hospital, and he got charged with murder, okay? He beat another man to death, okay? He beat the guy, and the guy died. The reason why I brought that up is, think about it. This was not a patient. This was somebody that worked there that ends up being accused of a beating and killing another man. Now, do you think that any of those patients would have been safe with this guy? That was, when I looked at that, I realized, you know, maybe he got, you know, fired really quick, who knows? But again, you know, when you hear these stories about what would go on in some of these asylums, don't get me wrong, there's a lot of the people that were there that unfortunately, because they just didn't have the drugs that we have now, that was the safest place for them. They would have been a danger to themselves and to others. But at the same time, you hear about these stories about the people that were there taking care of them. And yeah, that there was a lot of very good people and doctors. But at the same time, you had guys like this Barrett man who was a murderer. He was a murderer. Now it's 1927. And this is around the time that the hospital goes around and it changes its name to Eastern State Hospital. Okay. That's why I'm saying it went through like several different incarnations, even though through the years it would still kept being referred to as Lines View and the original name. Now, here's another one that I thought was really interesting. It's 1929. Okay. Now, 1929, I have to laugh because you look at this and it's incredible. 3 years earlier, okay, there is a man by the last name of Tipton. Okay. Now him and his wife, they take in four years prior, they had taken in a 13-year-old girl by the name of Lavella Winky. Okay. I guess she was to help around the house. 4 years prior, this girl is brutally murdered and her body, is hidden for several days. And finally they find it. I think it was buried under the floorboard, something like that. This poor man gets accused of and convicted of the murder. And right after he's convicted, he suffers a stroke. So he basically becomes crippled due to the stroke. Turns out that about 4 years later, his wife finally, and I don't know why, admits, I take that back. They were both jointly indicted for the crime, but he was the one that was convicted and went to jail for it. She finally admits, it was me. It was me. And she was declared insane by the state. Okay. And they had to let him go after 4 years. And she was judged insane. Was taken over to Eastern State for this crime. She had killed a 13-year-old girl. And they were saying, you know, at the end, where this man was 60 years old before the crime had been committed. And by the time he got out, his reputation was shredded and he had suffered a stroke and was crippled. So they didn't expect his quality of life to be that good. So, okay. All right, so then we're going into the 1930s, and I'm trying to paint this picture for you guys as that, you know, you could see how easily, you know, any spiritual turbulence there, because as you could tell by when I took those sweeps of the grounds, there's nothing there now. All the buildings are gone, but there was a lot of drama going on. Unfortunately, some of it pretty tragic. Now back, it's the 1930s, and now this hospital is starting to use various, what they call hydrotherapy and shock treatments. And you know, hydrotherapy is when they douse or they soak them several times, like alternately in hot water and then in cold water. And some of the observations was that the trauma seemed to produce some changes, or they thought that they did. And then, of course, electric shock therapy, where basically you're inducing a convulsion. Also, they started doing what they call psychoanalysis starts coming into that, which is like, basically, let's talk about it. But they didn't have that much money or the staff or the time for it. So basically, if you were in there, as far as your treatment, you were looking at electroshock treatment or hydrotherapy. Wow. Okay. So here it's 1933. And we have one of the asylum inmates takes his life. This was a man by the name of John W. Green. He was 85 years old, and he had spent 42 years as an inmate of Eastern State Hospital. And he was found floating in the Tennessee River. Okay, and basically that what he had done was he was weighted with rocks. And he had come into that hospital in 1891 after he had shot his sweetheart because she would not marry him. And then he wounded himself. I take it he had tried to commit suicide. He had lived there for 42 years. Ended up weighing himself with rocks and drowning. And I guess this is one of the examples when I say that by no means, there was a lot of people that were there that even though they weren't under the best circumstances, this is where they needed to be because they were dangerous. And look at this man. He killed a girl. He killed a girl. Okay. This is another one which I thought was, and the reason why I'm saying this is men and women here, it was like, and contrary to what a lot of people think, that sometimes, you know, insanity is very evident because people maybe talk to the air. You see people engaging in crimes and then you realize that they were insane. And of course, you know, they would be taken to the insane asylum versus jail. But again, in 1933, right, there's a robbery victim, a lady by the name of Mrs. Lenoire. Okay, she's got 5 children. Okay, she gets taken to the hospital because she tells the police that she's been attacked by bandits. And they took $2,100 from her, which, by the way, at that time, that's a lot of money. Turns out this was a figment of her imagination. And after they investigated, they realized that there was no robbery that occurred. And she was, and I quote, she was sent to the hospital on papers signed by her husband. You know what? You could think, oh, her husband was trying to get rid of her. You know what? With 5 kids, I doubt it. He probably needed her at home. If he wanted her to go into the hospital, this was just the latest probably in a series of incidents. Guarantee you. Okay, here we go. Now we're into the 1940s, 1940, and there's a newspaper article that comes out and it accuses the Eastern State staff of alcoholism, abusing patients and keeping them in what they considered inhumane conditions. And this is when they swap out like the superintendents, and they get the new superintendent. He constructs several new buildings, and some other what they call treatment buildings, which included electro, hydro, and hyperterm facilities. But he also started a patient newspaper, also a recreation and employee training programs, and community, you know, efforts. In other words, it sounds like he really cared about what happened to these people. And they said that he even knew a lot of stuff about the people, and he would just carry it in his head, and it didn't get written in their charts. And I think this is the first time that you see where it wasn't like, if you're going to go in there, that's it. You're going to stay there for the rest of your life. There's no hope, no cure for you. Because obviously he was trying to do something to improve them somehow, maybe with the hopes of letting them be out in the community. Okay, this is 1944. All right. And the Tennessee Valley Authority, they create what's called Fort Loudon's Lake. And what it does is it ends up covering much of the hospital's farmland. And they end up giving the hospital farmland in another part of the county. And that's why I'm saying all these hospitals, in a way, they maintained themselves by farming. They had their farmlands. They were self-sustaining. Okay, then it's 1949. They have a big fire there. They had one reported person. This was all but one of 152 mental patients. They were taken out of the dorms, and they couldn't find one. And one of the things that it brought down about two of the three wings of the dormitory before it was put under control. And they were noting that all the patients got really excited, and the caretakers, they had to turn them back, because once they exited the building, they wanted to try to go back in the buildings. They had to be turned back when they tried to re-enter the burning west wing. Again, that tells you the level of, you know, of unfortunate insanity that some of these people, you know, suffered from, that they were going to try to re-enter a burning building. Okay. It's 1953 now, and the state creates what they call the Department of Mental Health. And what they do is they take the hospital and they remove it from the prison system. And that was what I talked about, that prior to this, if you had committed a crime and you were charged or basically convicted, but you were found to be insane, you didn't go to prison, you got to go here. And you know what? That's a little bit scary, because you were basically putting people that maybe had some type of mental disorder but were not criminals, and you were throwing them with the criminally insane. Yes. And also, this was around the time that they were gearing towards helping the mentally ill function in society. And also, they discovered the effects of Thorazine on the mentally ill. And they started going towards more pharmaceutical-based treatments. In other words, they were, instead of just electroshock treatments or hydrotherapy, you know, they were looking at alternatives with drugs. Now, this is 1954. There's another one that made me laugh. There's an inmate. His name is Freddie Crabtree, and he's serving time for a second-degree murder in the hospital. And he was found selling hogs he had stolen from the hospital where he had been assigned as a trustee. Okay. He reveals not only had he been selling stolen hogs that were property of the hospital, but he had been home several times since he had been sent to the hospital in 1951. And the hospital aide was fired as a result of this incident, which tells you that hospital aide was looking the other way when probably he was supposed to be supervising this guy. So here's this guy who had been judged criminally insane after committing second degree murder, and not only is he going back home, he's selling the hogs that belong to the hospital. All right, yeah, there we go. All right, here's another one. Same time, 1954. There's a man, all right, and this is something that hasn't, there's a man, this is like a murder-suicide situation. He comes to the hospital where she worked at, okay? They live close by. Goes to the hospital where she works at, shoots her. Luckily, he doesn't kill her, but his intention was to kill her because I believe he shot her in the neck. And then he went home and he fired two bullets into his head. And they were not able to establish any motive for the shooting, but yeah, who knows what went on there. Then where it's 1960, and they open what they call the Therapeutic Village, which is where they made like 12 cottages, a chapel, and shops. And in one of the locations, I don't know if you could see that chapel when I was out there. And basically, again, it's where they're preparing to get people that were, I guess, not as severely ill to be able to function in society. Now, this is the thing. This village, it can accommodate only 240 of the 2,800 patients. Okay, 2,800 patients. All right. And most of these people remain locked in overcrowded wards. Remember, this is 1960. By this time, this hospital is going, what, an 80, being 80 years old? Something like that. Then 1965, the name is changed now to Eastern State Psychiatric Hospital. Now then comes 1966. Here's another possible candidate for hauntings. They have a woman patient at the hospital. She drowned in the Fort Loudoun Lake after she escaped from an aide who had been assigned to her because of her history of suicide attempts, and she was despondent. And her name was Arwilda McAdry. She was 36 years old. And that basically what she did was she just broke away and she ran away. And that he went to for help, and they just recovered her body like 2 hours later. Okay, so. Okay, let's fast forward now. Where it's 1971. And this is when the hospital's biggest scandal unfolds. All right, and this is when a journalist from the Knoxville Journal and a state representative by the name of Richard Krieg pay a midnight visit to the hospital. An unannounced midnight visit, I'm sure. And they report about the overcrowded, unsanitary, and unsafe conditions. And then, of course, the state holds formal hearings, and several of the hospital administrators either quit or are fired, and they name a new superintendent. And again, they start trying to either use more use of drugs and try to move them back into the community using outpatient programs and halfway houses. And if you look at the history, a lot of these asylums around the country, this is around the time that a lot of these big time mental asylums, they started to basically disassemble them. And they were hoping that they were going to have community centers to treat some of the mentally ill, which, by the way, did not work out the way they planned. And I think that's why a lot of mentally ill people now end up in jail. But yeah, now this is 1972, and this is the wings of the original hospital are demolished, and it becomes the first state hospital to admit all minors to a unit separate from adults. Okay, that is very interesting. They also start in 1973 what they called Overlook Mental Health Center, and what they're doing is they're doing outpatient treatments. Also around this time they start paying, they there was a lawsuit brought, and they start paying the patients for any work that they do, whether, you know, it's farming, laundry, all that other stuff. 1976, they changed the name to Lakeshore Mental Health Institute. By the 1980s, of course, its budget is continuing to shrink. And of course, they have no choice, but they start releasing more and more of these patients back into the community and cutting the staff. And in 1981, the state turns most of it over to a private company. And this is when I think they start thinking about selling that land. and they, you know, it's limping along. Then in 94 was the first time that they got 80 acres of the lakeshore property becomes a public park. And eventually, though, by 2012, it's finally totally shut down. Okay. Now, what I didn't know at that time was that there is a cemetery. It's located on Lionsview Drive. It's right across the street. I did go in and I did see the military cemetery. And apparently this cemetery lies behind that one, but on the same grounds. Right adjacent to what they call the Tennessee State Veterans Cemetery. That's where it's at. And right what they say behind the Episcopal Church of the Ascension. And supposedly it has about 4,000 interments, which, by the way, I think less than 10, maybe 20% of the interments are recorded. Most of them, of course, being unmarked. The number of markers were erected by the hospital at one time, but these records have long since destroyed as a result of the Privacy Act. I don't understand why, what has to do with privacy. And the few graves that have markers were usually set up by family members. And again, you know, there were some families that came and, you know, when a family member died, they would take him back to their cemetery. But now, another thing that I thought I was not aware of, it became the custom after the 1960s to send unclaimed bodies to the Memphis State Medical Facility for use in classroom studies. Okay. What that means is that if somebody died and nobody came, no family came to claim that body, which I'm pretty sure there was a lot, they would basically turn these bodies over for dissection, I imagine, or for whatever. I mean, what else are you going to use a body for at a medical facility? Okay. And now, as far as the hauntings are concerned, all right. There's, like I said, as far as photographing stuff, considering that a lot, and that was another thing, and you noticed it, like, it's a county park. A lot of these parks, by the way, which it's gated, I couldn't get in there after dark. Okay, so people that have gone there earlier, when there were some of the buildings, they could get in there after dark. I couldn't. Now, there is supposed to be an entity that frightens and scares the trespassers. It's felt out in the fields. Okay, usually around the remains of where original structures were, and one of the things is that this entity, it tells the trespassers to leave. So a lot of people consider that this is an intelligent haunting. In other words, this is not a residual, which I'm sure there's plenty of that there. Okay, absolutely, you are going to get lots of residual stuff just because how long, you know, the buildings were there. And I imagine that there was also a very regular type of routine that was done just to handle the patients. They did catch an apparition in the newer facility, okay? And again, this is the thing. It would be so difficult to ever pinpoint who it could be that would be haunting this place. It's a cast of thousands, as far as I'm concerned, because just so many people lived and died there. Some of them died shortly after being there for a very short time. Others lived there 20, 30, 40 years. Some of them died, like, by taking their life. Others died from things like tuberculosis. Remember, there was a lot of diseases that when this sanitarium was set up. Now, can you imagine when you start sticking people that have mental illness in a confined space? It was very easily to, you know, especially like tuberculosis, to basically pass it on to other patients. And now, I also read that that there were rumors of satanic activity at one of the abandoned buildings, and this supposedly happened during the 1970s. And this was after the land around the building had been flooded, cutting it off from the rest of the Lakeshore facility. There was another rumor that said that there was an unstable man, I take it maybe a homeless man, that lived in an old mobile home, and he guarded the site. I don't know if there's any truth to it. I tried looking up things in newspaper. I couldn't find anything. That doesn't mean it didn't exist. And that basically he would threaten people to get off the land. You know, he would threaten people. Okay. So, like everything else, I would love that if anybody has any stories about this asylum, I would love to hear about them. Okay. Or what is the truth? You know, especially people that live in that area. You know, it was there for 126 years, and now it's a park, and especially now after it's a park. Okay, I was there, and you would see people walking and jogging, and they have a baseball field, and then they have that field where I see this guy open. There's nothing there. And it just so happens I catch him with one of those radar detecting companies. Who knows? You know, even though they have a cemetery that was basically across the street, again, who knows? So guys, I hope you enjoyed this video. I thought it was a super interesting place. I would have loved to be able to investigate it at night. Unfortunately, I couldn't. Okay, like I said before, I was kind of disappointed that they're trying to like basically just make believe that what it was used for just never happened. Yeah, like unless you lived there, you would know what that land was once used for. So anyways, hit the subscribe button. Hit the like button. Thank you so much for viewing. Catch me on Twitter and on Facebook, which is where I do a lot of live streaming. And thank you so very, very much for viewing the videos. Take care. You're all wonderful.